talking for the next few minutes with someone who lives not that far away from us, down in the South Chicago suburb of Bourbonnais. And his name is Gary W. Moore. He has written a wonderful book, which is about his father and the extraordinary experiences which his father had on baseball diamonds here and abroad. And it's really an amazing story. It's a story that's also tinged with some real sadness, but ultimately a very uplifting story called Playing with the Enemy, A Baseball Prodigy, A World at War, and A Field of Broken Dreams. And this is the kind of book that movies are made of. And who knows, maybe someday we will get to see this story up on the screen. At any rate, it certainly comes to life very vividly in the pages of this really finely written book. And Gary W. Moore, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you, Greg. Thanks much for being for allowing me to be here. I'm an honor and a privilege. Let me tell you, though, they're in pre-production for the movie now, so it's sooner than you think.
Oh, is that right? Well, Yeah. That's terrific news. Yeah. Oh, actually, you know, it's funny. I mean, I've read the book, and I've certainly looked at the cover. I missed right down in the bottom corner. It says, soon to be a major motion picture. Yeah. There you go.
Yep.
Well, I'm glad somebody took up my advice.
That's right.
Very good. judging from your biography, you have not written a book before. Is that right?
No, this is my first book. I've done a lot of writing in my life, industry articles, training manuals, those kind of things. And I'd always wanted to write a book, and so this is my first attempt, and very excited about it, and so far so good.
You open your preface by saying, history has little to say about Warren Eugene Moore.
Yeah.
That is your father, born and raised in a tiny town in Illinois, and someone who actually might be a very familiar name to us were it not for the way in which history had a way of intervening.
Right.
But it's a really extraordinary story, and it's also a story which you almost never learned of from your father. I mean, it's really kind of frightening to think about how close you and all of us came to never hearing the story of your father's life and these experiences with the game that he loved so much. Tell our listeners a little bit how you finally were able to hear this extraordinary story from your father's lips.
Well, I grew up in Kankakee, Illinois, with a wonderful mother and father, but with a father who was a bread truck driver. That's all I knew him as. A wonderful father. I loved him, but you know, what he did for a living was a bread truck driver. And he was, you know, again, they were great parents. They would never miss anything that we did. I was very involved in music, growing bugle corps. My father would never miss anything, except baseball. I loved baseball as a kid. And when I'd have a baseball game, he wouldn't come. And he wouldn't play catch with me. And I never understood why until, as circumstances would have it, after I grew up and got to know my father as an adult, and with acting in business with him, he told me a story one day that just absolutely knocked my socks off, so to speak, and it's the story that became this book.
Tell us a little more about the circumstances of that conversation.
Well, my dad was 57 years old. We were in business together, and he had a heart attack. And it never occurred to me that you know, when I was 29, my dad was 57, I didn't think about him dying. You know, he wasn't of an age yet where I worried about him dying. His parents had lived well into their 70s, and so I assumed he would be with us for a long time. Well, he had a heart attack, went to the hospital. They diagnosed it as not being a heart attack, but sent him for some additional tests. I went with him to get the tests, met with the doctor, and the doctor said he agreed with the original prognosis. He didn't have a heart attack. And so we went to dinner that night. It was May 12th, 1983, and I had it on my mind that I thought that I was going to lose my father, you know, because of this heart attack, and of course now he was going to be okay. But I knew there was a lot about his life I didn't know. My father, I guess, you know, much like most people of that generation, you know, the generations that's now been dubbed the greatest generation, they just didn't talk about their war experiences, didn't talk about their past. And so I started pressing my father about his life. You know, I wanted to know the story. There were little things that I had learned along the way that had surprised me. We used to go to Sester, Illinois, the small town where he's from, and people would stop me on the street and say, well, are you Gene Moore's kid? And I'd say, yeah, and they'd say, your father was an incredible ball player. And they would start telling me stories about what a great ball player he was. Well, I would ask my dad, I'd say, well, these people say you were a great baseball player. I didn't know you played baseball. And he would just kind of laugh and say, it's a town of 700 people. You don't have to be very good for them to think you're a great baseball player. And he would shrug it off. When I was 12 years old, I was late for school one day, and I needed some socks. And so my mother said, well, your feet are getting big. She says, go get some socks out of your father's sock drawer. I reached to my father's sock drawer and pulled out an old yellow envelope from the Pittsburgh Pirates that were reporting instructions for my father. I asked him about it, and he seemed very upset that I found it and wouldn't tell me about it. And so at 29 years old, he's 57, we had a brush where I thought I was going to lose him. I insisted he tell me the story. And so after a lot of prodding and insistence, he told me the story that became the basis of this book.
I think, jump in for a moment. Mm-hmm. As you recount this conversation with your father, I mean, mm-hmm. the conversation before he finally agrees to tell you this story, and
right.
in that moment where he's still being really reluctant,
right.
you ask him, Dad, why won't you talk to me about this? And you have him saying, because it doesn't matter. It means nothing. And
right.
besides, it's just not an interesting story. I've put
right.
that part of my life behind me. He paused and thought for a moment. It just doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
I thought that was so well put. I mean, whether or not those are exactly your father's words, I trust he said something at least close
yeah.
to that.
Yeah.
And I think that reticence that some people have about talking about their past, be it something sad or even something happy, is that often for them, they think of those past events as things that do not exist anymore.
Right.
And for that reason, don't need to be talked about. And, of course, that's one way to look at it, but it's not the way most of us look at it.
No, I think that you know, there was this feeling of disappointment disappointment in two ways. First of all, he was disappointed that his career didn't go as he hoped. But his greater disappointment was that he felt he let the people of Sester, Illinois down. He loved this little town and loved the people in it, and they were so supportive of him. And they really thought they were going to have their day in the major leagues through him. And he felt he let them down. And so I think that was part of the reason that he just kind of tucked it away and didn't. To him, it was dead. To him, it was almost as if it never happened. It didn't exist.
Well, fortunately, your father finally agrees after all of your prodding
right.
to actually tell you this story.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine a story this rich and complex was not told in a single telling.
Well, from him it was, because as we talked about in the book, the bizarre set of circumstances is that he told me the story over about a 3-hour period, and he died the next day.
Well, that's right.
And,
actually, I am embarrassed to say,
yeah.
but I forgot that. That's right.
Yeah, and so I started, you know, after we got to the shock of his death, of a loss, I started telling my family the story. Well, my mother, she already knew the story, and so she started filling in details. And over a 20-year period, I would we'd go to his hometown and visit, and I would ask people questions, and they would tell me more.
Hmm.
And so this book is a compilation of oral histories, discussions with people who played with him, people who knew him, information gleaned from a letter from the Pittsburgh Pirates, and the conversation we had where my father recounted his life that really kind of put this together. This is not a strict historical biography as such. You know, it's based on the inspired by the true events of his life, and I think it's more of a story of rather than history. It's more of a story of character, perseverance, and what a man does with second chances in life.
Hmm. Well, but you have based this on as much factual information as you could possibly find.
Right, right. Because my father was not a historical figure. There, you know, as the first part of the book says, you know, there's very little written. You know, or known about Gene Moore, which is true, and so we really had to dig into the memories of people, and what's amazing, Greg, is since the book has come out, I've heard from probably 15 to 18 people who knew him, played with him, who gave additional information, but just really verify the authenticity of the story. So
wow.
it's very exciting for us.
We're speaking with Gary W. Moore about his book, Playing with the Enemy, A Baseball Prodigy, A World at War, and A Field of Broken Dreams, that baseball prodigy, was Gary Moore's father. He grew up in the little town of Cesar, and one thing that's so interesting is, if I read your book correctly, even back in 1940, this pivotal moment when his baseball talents first became known to the outside world, so to speak, you describe Cesar as a town already then that was dirt poor and seemingly dying.
Right.
So in a place like that, of course, to have a prodigy in their midst with the potential for something very exciting happening to them, I mean, that would be that would mean a tremendous amount to a community like this.
Right. Yeah, it certainly meant a lot to that little town, and still does. I was just there for an event, and they, you know, here we are over 50 years later, and they still remember, and they still talk about it, and there's still kind of the memory of those days. And the town hasn't changed much, which is really interesting. It's a town that's kind of off the beaten path, and the downtown of Cesar, Illinois, as much as it is depicted in the book, and hasn't changed much since then.
Interesting. Your father was a brilliant catcher, but more than that, I think he's 15 years old in 1940, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
But what was so impressive to him and so impressive to this Frank Boudreau, who was a scout for the Brooklyn Dodgers, was not just his ability as a catcher, but the way that this youngster knew the game.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, my dad was a, again, when I use the word prodigy, because, you know, it's a person who performs far beyond their, you know, chronological years and maturity. He had such a passion for the game. I mean, he lived it, breathed it. That's all he wanted to talk about. It's all he wanted to do. He believed that the only reason he was placed on this earth was to play baseball. And so he was not just a great player, but a student of the game. And he really understood the detail, and something that, that, you know, they really struggled with whether they should actually sign a 15-year-old. You know, to my knowledge, that's only happened 3 times in history where a 15-year-old has been signed.
Hmm.
But the reason they signed him was because of his, you know, what they basically thought was his baseball IQ, his deep understanding of the details of the game.
I thought it was interesting, too, when this Frank Boudreau apparently asked your dad why he loved to catch. This is the answer you have your father giving. Because I love baseball, and I'm the only guy on the field who can watch the whole game.
Yep.
Mr. Boudreau, squatting behind the plate, I have the best seat in the house, and I hope I can do it forever. Explain what happens next, how history intervenes.
Well, you know, my father, like everyone of his generation, they had plans and dreams for the future, and events on December 7th, 1941 changed that, and changed it for an entire nation, in fact, an entire world. My father was waiting for instructions. He was, you know, he was told that he would move up in the Dodgers organization for the 1942 season, and of course, when Pearl Harbor happened, it changed everything. You know, baseball was in doubt. They didn't even know if baseball would continue through the war, because they knew that every able-bodied man was going to be needed. And so the wealthier teams in baseball, and when I say the wealthier teams, that's a strange thought for most people today, because most people today look at, you know, with revenue sharing in baseball, that, you know, all teams are wealthy. And back then, the wealthy teams were in New York or there in Chicago. Everybody else was kind of, you know, straggling behind. Well, the wealthier teams put up money with what was then called the War Department to start touring baseball teams, where they would take their young, talented kids, put them on these baseball teams so they could continue to develop their skills and entertain the troops. And my father was put on what was called the United States Navy North African Touring Baseball Team. And they were sent to North Africa to play against the United States Army North African Touring Baseball Team. The Army team was largely composed of and supported by the Yankees. My dad's team was composed of kids from the Dodgers, and they spent their war years following Patton's 7th Army through North Africa and playing baseball.
You tell this in really interesting detail about how that team was gathered together and how, you know, one had to really play well to make the cut, and in fact, your father was one of 3 fine catchers, and only 2 were going to be part of this team. So the pressure was on, and your father was able to very assuredly make this team and gain this precious spot on the roster.
Yeah, that team was like, I guess, not unlike any professional or college team today, where, you know, it gets past the point of trying to let everybody have a chance to play. You perform and help the team win, or you don't stay on the team. And that was very much the way with this team. They started out with three catchers. They said they were only going to take two. And so they knew one of them was going to go. And the interesting thing, I think, one of the things I remember my father very vividly telling me was it was the first time in his life that he ever thought for a second that he had to worry that he wasn't good enough or that he wouldn't make the team.
Hmm.
Because before then, he was always, everywhere he went, he was the best.
And head and shoulders, the rest. I mean, it wasn't even close. And
yeah, and it turned out with the Navy that it was the same there. But it was the first time he ever really felt that sense of competition.
One thing that is so striking, I mean, I never even knew that such a thing existed, and I have a feeling a lot of people reading your book will probably be in the same boat, just never even knew that such baseball teams were organized to entertain our troops, in this case in North Africa. And I thought this was so interesting when you discuss what life was like for these young men. You say, rarely was any mention of war discussed. While the country mobilized its vast resources to fight a global conflict, producing equipment and supplies, training men to fight and women to work on the home front, Gene, Ray, and the rest of the team played baseball. Right. They were lost in their love for the game and obsession to play well. Most of the time, they had to remind themselves that they were in the Navy and their country was fighting a world war.
Yes.
What an interesting life for them to be leading.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. It's hard for the younger generation today to understand the passion for the country had for baseball back then. Certainly, baseball is a big sport today, but it's one of many sports. In 1941, there were really two. You know, we didn't have television. We didn't have the internet, video games, so on and so forth. And really, there were two large big sports that were entertaining to the country. It was baseball and horse racing. And every kid grew up playing baseball. I mean, it was so rare for somebody to not play baseball back then. And so when the country went to war, today when our country goes to war, we send our television stars, our personalities, country and western singers, so on and so forth, over to war to entertain the troops. Back then, the troops wanted baseball. And so, much like the USO tours of their time, these baseball teams were used to entertain the troops.
Hmm. One thing that was very interesting in when they finally began getting ready to play their first game against the U.S. Army exhibition team, the question was posed to their coach,
mm-hmm,
about where they were going to be playing, and will it be in the same place, or will we move around? And the coach answered that they want us close enough to the front to be able to bring troops out for a day of baseball and return them the same day. But we have to be far enough away not to put the troops or ourselves in the line of fire.
Right.
And finally he says, war is new to me too. I mean, he's trying to figure this all out. But,
right.
But what an intriguing thing to be doing. And, of course, other kinds of troop entertainment since then has faced that same quandary of where to do this to keep everybody safe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, war is obviously such a terrible thing and so stressful and on the human body and mind that I think, you know, all through recorded history there have been efforts to be able to, you know, take the minds of the troops off of the conflict for a few moments to replenish themselves. And in this case, it was baseball. And again, they have to be close enough that they can do the entertaining, but far enough away that they don't put them at risk. In fact, there is a case in the book where they were at risk one day.
Right, a really terrible story that we can let people read about. At one point, you say war and baseball seem to carry on as if in parallel theaters.
Yes.
Well, eventually, this chapter of your father's life ends when America's activity in North Africa essentially ceases.
Yeah.
I mean, as we focus our efforts in other places, most notably in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't stopped to think about this, but apparently it was felt that it wasn't very workable to do this kind of thing in Europe. That is,
right.
And is that just because of the layout of the land just didn't allow it in the same way?
Well, I don't think it was that. It certainly might have been part of it. But my suspicion is, when D-Day happened, they really, the government, leadership really thought that they would move through Europe pretty quickly. They didn't think that they would get bogged down in some place the way they did. And I think that they thought that, they felt that if they were going to move through pretty quickly, they didn't need the baseball teams. The baseball teams would end up being more of a hindrance than a help. And they would just kind of fight through it, get home, and let them watch baseball at home. And so they sent the baseball teams home. My father ended up in Norfolk, Virginia, and they didn't know what to do with the baseball team, because one of the things we should mention is the baseball team had never had basic training. They went to Chicago, to Great Lakes Naval Air Base, and had one day of swim training, and that's all they had. Then they broke up into the teams and went off to play. So they had never shot a gun. They had never had any formal naval training. And so all of a sudden you have these group of, sailors that they didn't know what to do with.
Sailors who aren't really sailors in
no.
a sense.
No.
Aren't trained to do anything. Your father at one point, when asked about this, said, our basic training was really just spring training.
Right.
It was baseball training, not training to be someone in the Navy.
Right.
So they are dispatched back. In fact, it's kind of a poignant moment where this U.S. Navy baseball team is dispatched back home, but the U.S. Army team, which they've
right.
been playing, they are redeployed.
Right.
They don't go home, and so they made sure that this news was shared with the teams separately, so the one wasn't celebrating in front of the other.
Right.
So your father is dispatched back home, and he ends up he and his teammates become guards of an extraordinary prison camp here in the United States. Tell
yes.
our listeners about who was imprisoned there.
Well, it's such a bizarre twist of fate. The Navy team is at Norfolk, Virginia, at the Naval Air Base there. They didn't quite know what to do with them. And at 2 o'clock in the morning or so, the team was rousted out of bed by the shore patrol and taken to a Quonset hut, where they were told that they were needed for a secret mission. The team thought it had to be some type of joke because they had no training. And they said, they said, in fact, they had captured a German submarine off the coast of Africa. The submarine had been towed to Bermuda, where they were hiding it. And the sailors were actually, from the submarine, were actually brought to Norfolk, Virginia for processing. And they said, we're sending you ahead to Ruston, Louisiana, to help set up and prepare for their arrival, and you're going to guard these prisoners. Well, the baseball team couldn't understand that. Well, why us? Well, the reason ended up being that these particular sailors were being held in some ways like they were in Guantanamo Bay today. They were being held separate from the Geneva Convention. They were kept top secret because they did not want the Germans to know that we had these sailors and that we captured the submarine. Because with the capture of the submarine, we captured the German Enigma machine, which is the coding and decoding device that really gave the Allies a lot of answers.
And if the Germans had known we had done this, they would have taken preemptive action to change those codes.
Right, right. And this is not a political book as such, but I find it so humorous. I watch the news today, and politicians and people are screaming that we're doing something we've never done before in Guantanamo Bay and with these secret camps in Europe. And the truth of the matter is we've done it in every war. Whether it's right or wrong, that's for somebody else to judge. But the fact of the matter is it's happened in every war.
It's not as unprecedented as some would say.
Not at all.
Interesting.
Not at all.
You say that these Germans were held not as prisoners of war, but under a classified program that allowed us to deny that we were holding them at all.
The exact name of the classification, it's escaping me right now, but basically it was what they called an anti-Nazi program. They were claiming, the reason they were being able to hold is that the Germans had voluntarily given up the ship and asked for political asylum. They didn't want to be Nazis anymore, didn't want to be Germans anymore, so to speak. And so because they had done this, they didn't have to, they weren't technically prisoners, and they didn't have to be proclaimed to the Geneva Convention. Now, that was not true. The Germans did not do that. But that was their justification in holding them. Hmm. Now, they were held at Camp Ruston, Louisiana, which was there were 30,000 German prisoners there, but they were kept away from the camp quite a ways so that they would have no fraternization with the other prisoners, because what their fear was is if one prisoner ever escapes, in some way they get the word back to Germany that they had these prisoners, and the Germans would change the code.
Hmm. The story is told one day of how you and your father are, your father and some of his teammates are playing catch outside of mm-hmm. kind of the holding pen of these German prisoners, playing catch, and a baseball kind of gets thrown over the fence by mistake. And as your father watches these Germans kind of playing with this ball for a few moments and actually refusing to throw it back,
right.
It dawns on him how bored these Germans must be. I mean, more bored than the Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to spark in him a really extraordinary idea. Tell our listeners about the idea which your father had and what he did about it, how he pursued that idea.
Well, they no longer had a team to play. And so they were playing catch and could scrimmage a little bit, but they felt that they, you know, these were all kids who were had a career and destiny in professional baseball after the war, and they felt their skills deteriorating. The one thing that my father told me was he said that the thing that struck him most about these Germans weren't angry, they weren't defiant, they were incredibly bored and sad. You know, they were away from home and there was nothing they could do about it. When they were playing catch one day, a ball ended up in the pen. The Germans wouldn't throw it back. In fact, they had a little fun with it. One of the Germans started using it very similar to what we would use, a hacky sack, I think it's called today, where he'd start bouncing the ball off of his feet. Well, soccer wasn't very big in the United States, or really not at all in the United States at the time. And so these ball players were just amazed to watch these Germans with what they'd do with this baseball. They realized some of these guys had incredible athletic skills, and so they came up with a scheme to get the Germans to be able to play baseball against the Americans, or play baseball with the Americans. And so they could get enough, you know, between the American team and these Germans, they'd get the best athletes and be able to play the games again. So my father and his teammates, we went to the superiors at the larger camp and just said this is what they wanted to do. And, of course, the superiors absolutely refused in the beginning. But through a little persistence, they convinced them. And that's where part of the title from the book comes from the fact that they started playing baseball with the enemy.
Hmm. It's interesting, and I appreciate your honesty about this in the book, that I think someone else telling the story of their own father would have told this story in a way which would have made your father's motives entirely noble, that your father did this more than anything out of concern for these Germans to give them something to do, that is, the Germans something to do, and maybe bridging the chasm between these peoples, maybe establishing friendships and so on. Really, the way it played out, we get the sense that if any of those motives were there, that they were not as important as your father's primary interest in playing baseball himself, he and his teammates, who felt
right.
like their skills were just rusting away. But, I mean, you know what I'm saying? I mean,
right.
Somebody could tell that story and give it a little different twist and really turn your father into a hero forever even thinking of such a thing.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of interesting that you've chosen to be pretty honest about the way this played out.
Well, it just wasn't the case. My father wasn't concerned about them at all, really. I mean, he was concerned about his team and his baseball skills. I mean, you got to put yourself in the mindset of the time. There were, you know, millions of people who were killed during this war and interred and damaged and in a world almost ruined by my father's view of what Hitler and the Nazis had done. And so I don't think he had any love or compassion for these people at all at the time. It was just a matter of, hey, this is an end to a means. Let's keep these prisoners to play ball. Now, over the course of playing baseball with them, that all changed. And, you know, I think that it's an example of, you know, sometimes when you get to know your enemy, you find out that in many cases, not all cases, but in many cases, you have more in common with them than differences. And it changes your view of them. But in this case, it was just a matter of let's use the Germans to keep up our skills.
Mm. It's so interesting to imagine that scene of these Americans and these Germans just trying to talk in
right.
terms of facilitating this happening.
Right.
Your father went through that in speaking with this German by the name of Mueller,
right.
In trying to make all of this happen, but not knowing German at all, and Mueller having only very limited knowledge of English. I mean,
right.
this was not an easy thing to accomplish.
No. I mean, there's certainly the language barrier. Then there's the fact that they are at war with each other. It was, I think, very difficult in the very beginning, and it got a little bit easier as they learned to trust each other and understand each other better. But it was a very difficult thing. And the fact is, the majority of the Germans refused to play. There were 53 Germans who were interred there from the submarine, and about 14 of them decided to play baseball. Some of the rest of them were very resentful and felt that the others were fraternizing with the enemy.
Hmm.
But
I think it's interesting, too, when as your father had kind of the first encounter with those Germans who had decided they would play.
Mm-hmm.
And so he is standing in front of them and holding up a ball and saying, "This is a baseball, and you hit it
yeah.
with this thing we call a bat." Finally, one of these kind of sees this look on the German's face, and finally
yeah.
one of them says, "We're not stupid." and I think that's really also a great little moment of frankness about how this was not as easy and rose-colored as we might hope it was.
Yeah, it's funny. Part of it, I guess, understanding what would happen there came from my business experience. I've done some traveling abroad in my business, and I'm always amused by watching Americans talk to people who don't speak the English language. They usually treat it as though they're deaf, and so what they do is they talk louder and slower. You know, and the fact of the matter is it has nothing to do with it. They just don't understand the language. And so I imagine it being much the same way there. You know, let's talk louder, let's talk slower, and then maybe through some magic they'll understand. You know, but the fact of the matter is if you don't speak the language, you don't speak the language.
Hmm. One thing that you choose to do as you tell the story of your father playing baseball with Germans is that there is a parallel war story being told about
mm-hmm.
his brother.
Yeah.
Just tell us about that for a moment and why you thought it was important that story be told alongside that of your father.
Well, I think I found that to be the most fascinating aspect of the story after I started telling it and became more and more intrigued by it. My father was there were two boys out of the seven, five girls in the family. My father was the youngest. Ward, his brother, I think it was typical of most oldest boys in the family. You know, the responsibilities of the family fall very hard on their shoulders. The expectations of the family name kind of ride on that. And in most cases, most oldest sons are the most serious in the family. Well, and that was the case with Ward and Gene. Ward was very, very serious and focused on life. Gene played baseball. And Ward developed a resentment growing up in the same household with Gene because he was the oldest son, but when he would go downtown and people would refer to him, they'd always refer to him as Gene's older brother. And so he felt that Gene got all this attention, but Gene got all this attention for wasting his time when Ward was actually working hard on the farm and trying to build a life, and he got no attention for it. But a weird twist happens. If they go off to war, Gene leaves as the hero, and he's expected to come back as such. Ward leaves as Gene's older brother, and Ward comes back an incredible war hero. And, you know, people, when they read this book, one of the things I always say is, now, the story about Ward in France, that can't be true, right? And it's very, very true. He actually saved the life of somebody from his little town of 700 people, and they didn't even know each other was there. And so, and I don't want to give too much of that away, but it's really a bizarre story, and it's absolutely true. The Ward comes back the hero because of a twist of circumstances and fate with Gene. Gene comes back depressed and fearing the loss of his career. And so they both leave for war and come back in reverse roles.
Hmm. Well, and living out such dramatically different experiences
oh, yeah.
through that war. I mean,
yeah.
It just could not be more different.
Right.
Of course, in many respects, the heart and soul of your book is how these Americans and Germans encounter one another and have this experience, who begin to grow closer to one another, sometimes in spite of themselves.
Right.
And as the war nears its end, I believe it is your father who comes up with the extraordinary idea of all of this, which they know has to end, mm-hmm. of it ending in something which he calls the friendship game.
Right, right. Yeah, they were so focused on playing baseball together that I get the feeling that they really didn't anticipate the end of the war and were surprised by it. And so when the discussions started popping up that these Germans should be prepared to transfer to another authority because they may be leaving Ruston, and that the war was coming to an end, and then in fact had come to an end, they wanted to have one last baseball game together, which to them was a big deal, and some people from the town turned out to see it, and that kind of thing. It was really a non-event in kind of a global sense, but it was very important to this team. They had this one last game, which they called the friendship game.
Your father, unfortunately, gets injured, fairly
yeah.
seriously injured, and this is part of what begins to cast kind of a dark shadow over your father in those next few years. I mean, for the fact that that this story ultimately is going to be a film, which mm-hmm. excites me very much, the fact is that this story does not really play out like a typical Hollywood script. I mean, we
no.
long for it to have a happier and tidier ending than it does. And I suppose that's one reason why it's important to tell this story.
Yeah, it's funny. One of the larger publishing houses, when I first took it, was kind of showing the story around, was very interested in publishing it, but said that we need to change the ending. He said that, what they said was, we need to have your father have this very happy ending, and maybe he could take a Little League team to the World Series to fulfill his destiny or something. And I thought that was so bizarre. I think that the best part of the story is the fact that it's every man's story. It doesn't have a clean ending. It doesn't have a rocky type of finish to it.
Right. And, you know, there's one chapter which is called Reality,
right.
chapter 27, and that's kind of this moment where your father comes back home to Cesar, Illinois,
yes.
His aspirations to be a professional baseball player have really turned to dust, and you know that's part of what this story is. I mean, this
right.
is real life, including disappointments.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he my father was the guy who thought that he was put on earth only to play baseball, and so all of a sudden, through a split second decision he made on a baseball field, in a game that meant nothing, he was faced with the fact that he may never play baseball again. And now he was an adult home from war and had never given a thought to what he would do, and never given a thought to the fact that he might not play baseball again. And so that particular chapter is kind of a very hard look at a man who had never had any plans in life other than what he thought was his destiny to play baseball, and what will he do now? I don't think that certainly, as you read the book, the choices he made, regarding his life, were not in his best interest at that time.
Right. He begins to develop a drinking problem.
Yeah.
I mean, trying to evade the terrible sadness which had to be there, sadness and disillusionment, and then life begins to turn around in part because of an extraordinary second chance.
Yeah.
Which he is given, and that's some of the most remarkable stuff in the book as well. Maybe some of that story we should leave to listeners to read in the book, unless there's something you want to say about that particular chapter.
Yeah, the only thing I would say is that my father seemed to have a guardian angel in this scout, Frank Boudreau. And in 1949, after several years of drinking and feeling sorry for himself and letting his life almost slip away from him, the same guy who scouting for the Brooklyn Dodgers in 1940, showed up in 1949 in a bar and pulled my father out of that bar and gave him a second chance in life. And I think that I think it's the most critical part of the story, and really kind of a life-changing epiphany for him.
Well, and you know, I would hope that people would read that story, and if someone were ever in a position to give someone a second chance, that they might be even more motivated to do so.
Oh yeah.
When they see what Frank Boudreau did for your father, even though in the end it ultimately doesn't lead to a career in the major leagues. You do include, by the way, that extraordinary letter which you stumbled upon by accident in your father's dresser.
Right.
Your first inkling of this part of your father's life, about which at that time you knew nothing about, that letter from the Pittsburgh Pirates is reprinted at the very beginning of the book.
Yeah, we actually have a photocopy of the actual letter in the front of the book, because I think that it's very, very important that people see that letter and understand it, because in many ways the story seems unbelievable, and the letter is the verification that, you know, yeah, this is, you know, here's a letter from the Pirates in 1949. And it says, here's where you're reporting, here's where you're going. And in many ways, I've known this story now for over 20 years. I grew up with the man who's the subject of the story. And I still look at that letter, think about the story, and shake my head and just find it unbelievable.
Hmm. Before I let you go, we have to at least touch on one other chapter towards the end of the book.
Mm-hmm.
As your father has told you this extraordinary story, it prompts in you a question for your father, namely, you know, how much does he regret that all of this occurred?
Yeah.
I mean, if he could somehow rewrite the script of his life, would he have rewritten it to end more happily? Mm-hmm. Even if in the rewriting of it, that probably would have written you right out of existence. I mean, chances are, You would never have been born. His life would have followed an entirely different track. And
His
answer to that really interesting question is remarkable too.
Yeah, it's as I listened to the story, and I listened to the incredible sadness that he had regarding the story. You know, what kept coming to my mind is, had things turned out the way he wanted them to on a baseball diamond, he probably would have never met my mother, the family that we love, and if at this time probably wouldn't have existed. And so, in some ways, I felt it was an unfair question to ask him, but I had to know. You know, if he could change things, would he change them? And his answer was probably the most important words that I've ever heard him say. And so, it was really important, you know. To all of us, and certainly I think that they weren't just words. I think that that he had really come to the realization that the goals that we have in life are not the most important thing, but the striving for the goal, the journey that takes us to the goal, is really what forms us into who we are. And his reaching for the brass ring, reaching for this goal that he had strived for, it really developed the personality of a man who went on to be very successful in business, a strong business leader, a great father, a great husband. And so it's more important what we become in the process of reaching for our goals than actually achieving the goal itself.
Hmm. And your father, your book tells us that your father, if anything, was finally assured of all of this in the end when he got to reconnect with one of those Germans many years later. In a what amounts to a beautiful postscript to an already very, very compelling story.
Well, one of the things I didn't mention, and I should, is the submarine question is the U-505. The U-505 is kept at the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago, and so I'm sure a lot of people from Milwaukee have visited that sub and seen it and heard about it. Well, over the course of a 20-year period, over half of the sailors who had served on the U-505 came to Chicago to visit their old boat. Well, one of them knew my father lived in the Chicago area somewhere, and the folks at the museum helped him find him and came to visit him. and they had a discussion about life, and here this former enemy, former opposing teammate, really, I think more than anybody, helped my father reconcile the events in his life and the fact that my father truly had everything he wanted in life and should appreciate and accept that.
Hmm. How long do we have to wait for this major motion picture?
Well, they finished the budget work in December. They are, right now they're in what they call pre-production, where they're doing two things. They're signing the principles, and so they're working on that now. They're doing site surveys, and they're planning to start filming in May. One of the most exciting things, I just heard this week from the producer who called me, that they think they're actually going to be able to film the prison camp sequences right on the exact same grounds at the prison camp. They think they know exactly where the baseball field was. They know where the buildings were. And so it'll actually take place in Ruston, Louisiana. That's not a done deal, but they're pretty sure that's going to happen. So that's really exciting.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, we hope that in every other way, too, they remain so true to this wonderful story as you've told it. Are you able to help ensure that, or are you just trusting that they'll do it?
Well, there's a couple of things there. I have in the contract what they call meaningful consultation rights, which my attorney tells me that they have to talk to me about everything, but then they can do what they want. So, at least they have to hear my views first. But the best part about it for me is my son, Toby Moore, who's an actor and lives and works in Hollywood. He starred in A Separate Piece. He starred in Murder in Greenwich. He's kind of an up-and-coming actor. He actually co-wrote the script, so there's been some family involvement and intervention there. And it was primarily written by a man by David Raines, who's an incredible young screenwriter, and he did a marvelous job with the story. But the most important thing is when we were first kind of showing the story around, one of the things I kept telling people is I want my son to play my father. And everybody, my lawyer, my agent, everybody says, if you make that a condition, this movie will never get made, so drop it. Well, the very first person that we took this story to was Gerald Mullen. Gerald won an Academy Award as a producer for Schindler's List. He's a frequent Spielberg collaborator. He worked on Jurassic Park. He most recently, Minority Report, he was executive producer on. So he's one of the biggest in Hollywood. We took it to him, and Gerald looked at it, read it, fell in love with the story, and came back and said he wanted to produce this movie. He was excited about it. They were going to put it on a fast track. But they only had one condition. And, I held my breath for a minute because I thought they didn't want to change the story. And he says, if we can sign the lead, then we'll do it. If we can't sign him, we won't. And I said, well, who do you want? And he smiled and said, Toby Moore. Mm-hmm. And so it's become a conversation between generations. My son is going to play his grandfather in a movie based on a book that his father had written. Mm-hmm. And so it's truly become a dream come true, and for anybody who wants to follow this, you can follow it on the internet at playingwiththeenemy.com.
And the book is Playing with the Enemy by Gary W. Moore. I'm Gregory Berg.
. 8:59, support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago. He later served as station manager and morning show co-host. 8:59, a minute in front of 9 o'clock. At 9 o'clock, we'll join Wisconsin Public Radio for their classical music programming. Let's get you updated on the weather forecast now from the National Weather Service. Today, cloudy, windy, and mild. Winds up to 25 miles per hour today, a high of 60. 50-50 chance of rain overnight, a low of 38. Wednesday, cloudy, windy, and rainy. Maybe some thunderstorms on Wednesday, a high of 43. Thursday, the storm comes through. It looks like we're dodging that bullet for the most part. Cloudy, windy, light rain, freezing rain, sleet, and snow, but very, very little accumulation. Thursday's high, 39. Here are the numbers right now. Wind from the southwest at 15, gusting to 21. Pretty much an overcast sky. The new numbers are in. 45 degrees in Racine and Kenosha. 42 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. 40 degrees in Milwaukee. Just about 9 o'clock. This is WGTD HD. Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. NPR News and classical music on your gateway to public radio.